Greetings. This is the kickoff slide for my second webinar out of 11 in a total series about helping manufacturers and their distributors seeing and getting to the electronic commerce future of 2023, before the laggards, and in a sense to sort of blunt or anticipate Amazon businesses' plans. And you can see in this particular webinar, I've entitled Amazon Business Effects. So they're both direct and indirect. And I think that Amazon, besides being a foe, they can be a friend and a role model. In number one session, I talked a lot about that third bullet point, which is don't underestimate the innovative ambitions of Amazon and specifically Amazon Business. And an underlying theme through everything is why it's vital to have what I call net profit analytics. In other words, to know the actual net profit you're making on customers and stock keeping units and vendor lines and so forth. Because going forward, we're going to have to unweave and reweave our economic sort of business selling service models at the channel level, at the business level, and at the e-selling level. I put down here some specific uses for the slideshow, and you'll notice that if you want copies of the slides I'm using, this particular deck, if you just email me, bruce@merrifield.com, I'll send you the slides that we're looking at. I also have a master deck for all 11 webinars, if, you know, trade associations, buying groups, management teams of distribution companies, whatever, would say, well, I can't wait for all these things, you know, send me everything and I'm going to cherry pick what I want and so forth. And we're going to customize something with Bruce. That's a possibility. So let's get on with the show. Here in this slide, I'm talking about, you know, the different faces of Amazon. I mean, clearly they are a foe in the sense that they have inserted themselves between our next generation B2B millennial digital buyers who tend to want to go to Amazon first to learn about information, availability, pricing, you name it. And then, of course, Amazon is working aggressively to have all of us basically just switch from clicking and typing and so forth to just voice commerce. And people kind of can't get their head around the fact that that could be a distinct big, you know, share possibility by 2023, but 15,000 employees at Amazon are working on Alexa and all things Alexa, et cetera. So don't be surprised that the future isn't going to get here faster than we think. They also, in a sense, are going to steal some of our most shoppable spot on a stock keeping units on a spot buy basis. If I'm going to buy a very large ticket item, it's going to cost $1,000, and I bought it before, I buy five of them a year type of thing maybe, I might just routinely say, well, I'm going to go check at Amazon. Oh, my gosh, here's the same brand for less than what my distributor has quoted. Or who knew? There's a perfect knockoff clone with 5.0 reviews for 50% of the cost. Gee, I'll go give last look to my normal distributor supplier of this item. And of course, it's very difficult for you to meet that price when you need all that margin dollar to pay for all the losing stock keeping units you have, all the losing customers you have in your portfolio. So they will steal more or less SKUs. I mean, if you look at, for example, in retail channels, they're only taking 2% of tires and batteries, but they're taking 50% of the books. And even if you said, well, to the tire people, what tires are they taking? Well, they're taking passenger tires. They're not taking big truck tires yet, or diesel tractor things or whatever. But, you know, they're relentless. So they're going to continue to creep into wherever they can, steal some business. So right here, what's the point? Basically, we have to reduce cross-subsidized SKU pricing. And in another thing, we have to do what Amazon can't. I'll come back to that. And on SKU pricing, appreciate this. I mean, if you sell a $2 item and you have 50% markup or margin percent in it, that's $1 of margin dollars. Humans can't pick stuff in a warehouse for that. So you're obviously losing money on that line item just from fulfillment activity costs. On the other hand, if you're selling a skid of something at 20% and the skid's, you know, $2,000, that's $400 of margin dollars. And you may say, well, I want to allocate a bigger pick cost and, you know, delivery cost because it's taking up more of my truck or whatever. But still, the odds are the total activity costs are going to be less than $400, and you actually make some net profit on that. So that would be a cream item, and that's cross-subsidizing the highly popular, very small dollar picks where you're enchanted with the margin percent. It's just that there's no margin dollars to cover your activity costs. As far as being a friend, you know, if they control the eyeballs and the eyeballs want to go and learn on their own online first before calling you, you've got to oblige them. Otherwise, the clones are going to be there and they're going to oblige them. They're going to start stealing share from the number one brands. So the brands are going to be forced to basically have some kind of digital content engagement strategy and win. And they, you know, they may not sell their stuff to Amazon or even sell their stuff directly to the end user, but they may have to be there to have, you know, an initial buying journey, marketing presence awareness. But that then starts to sort of have knockoff effects or ripple effects on what's the channel model going forward that big brands are going to do with their distributors if you start in a different buying journey scenario. And Amazon can also be a friend if distributors say, wait a minute, I'm going to take all my dust collectors and I'm going to put them on there just like used book guys do. And I'm going to charge whatever the traffic will bear. I found out that my grandfather had written a book in 1929. I got on the web and found out there were four copies, all for about $8. So I bought all four of them and then gave them to, you know, my dad and my brothers. And then somebody else said, well, where do I get a book? I said, well, go to Amazon. They called back or emailed back and said, yeah, well, but there's one there, but it's for $92. I mean, that's how fast these used book guys figure out a family reunion just happened. And there's a run on these books. Boom, crank the price. So you could be opportunistic with your dust collecting items. There's also, if you take, you know, the number one best-selling SKU you have and say, wait a minute, if I basically said I will ship it, but I'll have one day shipping only from my warehouse in this metro marketplace. Otherwise, it's 5 to 8 days. I could charge 20, 30, 40% more than the list price. And blow, because Amazon has so much traffic, you may actually sell, you know, be able to pay all their fees and still make good money on just the convenience factor that somebody just randomly wants to buy it. They don't care what the price is. They just want to be able to track it and get it tomorrow. So that might be a possibility or a little business model you could use also. But most importantly, I think, to see them as a role model and try to copy their innovative practices. You know, B2B buyers all want the Amazon experience, not just at home, but on the job, at work. So I have to ask, who are your two pizza teams that are innovating to change how you sell to give these B2B buyers what they want? I'm just going to put the question out there and not dive into the details right now. And I think that the bigger opportunity for many distributors is not that Amazon business is going to dent you for that much or steal that much of your cream SKU, you know, profit. If you can figure out how to give your rising B2B millennial, you know, buying influences at your biggest accounts exactly what they want, you are going to, you know, retain and get more share or crack accounts better than your legacy slowpokes, you know, competitors who just keep doing what they're doing. So I'll put a question on here. Which distributor will be first at getting better in a sort of an e-commerce way at creating total replenishment systems for best customers? And best customers aren't just big customers. Some of them are innovators called gazelles, perpetual innovators, and they're growing 2, 3, 4 times faster in the industry because, and they're eating other people alive because they just have a better value for their end users. So if you marry partner gazelles, they grow you. And not all big customers are necessarily profitable. That's another day, another story. Webinars 3 through 7 get into, you know, the whole world of net profit analytics and insights and plays that come with those analytics. Next slide here. To look at what Amazon can and can't do so far, I mean, first of all, they can sell spot buy shoppable stock keeping units that also fit into their expanding infrastructure. Initially, they're basically saying, we're a big warehouse and whatever we can ship UPS, so it's a good quality freight. They weren't shipping steel or lumber or, you know, cases of towels and tissue or, you know, plastic can liners or something like that. But when I say expanding, they're now like their 9th, 10th generation warehouses, and some of them are 4 and 5 stories in tight little urban areas. And they're going to go aggressively after, you know, half day shipping parts, things like that. But they do have also bulk storage, and they have bulk delivery partners. So how much more aggressively will they get in that? We'll see. Later on, we'll look briefly at their 11 and improving winner-take-all integrated platforms. So one platform reinforces the other, and they compound on one another, and it's a unique infrastructure that's unmatchable and it's uncatchable. Certainly we have to worry about, you know, shoppable, popular, high-ticket, you know, SKU spot buying. But they certainly right now can't go out to a customer and say, look, you know, we have everything you buy. You know, if we don't, we'll put it in stock. The question is, how do we get our one-stop shopping, you know, array of stuff to and through you at the lowest total procurement cost, giving you also zero expediting, the most uptime, productivity, and then your people do what they need to do to take care of your customers so you can retain them better. That would be a very holistic, integrated sole supply pitch, if you will. And even the distributors that go after integrated sole supply, frankly, you know, based on my personal experience, don't do that very well. It's kind of a hit or miss thing. And a lot of those big contracts are not profitable. So they can't yet do that. So we should probably try to figure out how to get better at that than what we're doing. But Amazon Web Services, got a bunch of brilliant software guys, et cetera. They're going to continue to come up with workarounds that allow them to, you know, make inroads. For example, they weren't doing so well with tires because they're big and they're bulky, and, you know, ship 4 tires in my house, and what am I going to do with them? So they said, all right, what we'll do is we'll partner with national tire, you know, stores. And when you come and, you know, you go to Amazon and you type in passenger tire, there are over 4,000 hits, and you click on Prime only, and there's 3,000 hits. And so you zero in there and you figure out the tire you want. But as you're checking out, you now can book the tire center nearest you to have the tires delivered there, and you can schedule the time that they're going to be installed, and you can meet so you go there and meet your car, or take your car, meet the tires, have them done, and you get a discount from the tire vendor, Monroe, Pep Boys, Sears, et cetera, because you're a Prime member. And they go, oh, wow, that's kind of clever. And they did the same thing when it came to MRO SKUs with very large corporations. You know, millennials would come into, you know, purchasing people and say, wait a minute, I get in the internal catalog, I get this stupid little picture of something I need, I can see what they're going to charge my department, and I don't know when I'm going to get it. And I'd like to have it right away. Well, I go to Amazon, I can see they've got even cooler stuff for less prices, and I can get it for sure tomorrow. Why can't I buy it? Because we can't control it. So Amazon Web Services says, fine, here in the cloud are free central spend management tools that are better than your SAP central spend management tools. And boom, the volume goes from 0 to 20% plus as far as MRO spend at these large sprawling behemoths with their central control spend management guys. So what are some items that of SKUs that Amazon hasn't yet hit? So these are criteria, really, that you can apply to say, am I vulnerable on a given SKU or category or not? So obviously they've not gotten anything that requires additional value-added activities, you know, people doing stuff to the product. So if you have packaging with the customer's name on it and you're stocking it, they're not going to do that. If you bring in a spool of copper wire and you cut it to length and you re-spool it up, they're not doing that yet. When it comes to assembly, kitting, equipment repair, et cetera, they're not doing those things yet. And I'm not, and they may never, you know, what are the odds? I don't know. I'm talking to 150 different distribution channel creatures here. If you have an exclusive, unique brand, for example, you are a Coca-Cola bottling company, well, they're not going to be getting a Coca-Cola bottling unless you decide to sell Amazon that way. Here, so far, they've not gotten into bulky, low-quality freight. However, they've come up with a new brand called Amazon Commercial, and the first things they have are cases of toilet paper and tissue and can liners. And so if you sell skids of, cases of, and it's always sold in cases, then they may start creeping in this. They may come up with a different model where, hey, you know, when you come to this particular area, if you buy even cases or skids, et cetera, here are truckloads coming in. We're going to offer you a discounted cross-docking, unbundled, you know, services for fees kind of business model. They could put a big hurt dance on a lot of those kinds of products. If you need a special kind of truck, I mean, if you look at a Coca-Cola bottling truck, you know, to be able to go out and take care of a vending machine or whatever, it's a peculiar kind of truck with a configuration. Obviously, fuel trucks that go to C-stores, gas stations, whatever, that's a very kind of special kind of truck. If you're selling cylinders of recyclable cylinders of oxygen and nitrogen, et cetera, so you're a welding gas supply distributor, you know, that's a package of stuff that generally they're not going to get into. Amazon does have general bulk partner delivery companies, but mostly so far they've gone after consumer appliances, they've gone after furniture. But they're relentless. They'll go after as much as they can get profitably, and so stay on guard. Any kind of products that require looking at blueprints, doing takeoffs, et cetera, additional training or repairs, again, they're not getting into that. I talked earlier about going out and doing one-stop shop system replenishment contracts where you design it, you install it, you tune it, you maintain it. You may even have inventory and consignment. You may have vending machines. That's a ball of problems they haven't tackled. If you are selling frozen, refrigerated, et cetera, so the cold chain, so far Amazon's not gotten into that. Heretofore, they had not gotten into alcohol, but now they've got liquor licenses, et cetera. I expect that they will come back aggressively and go after wine, for example, in some states. So far, they're not touching tobacco at all. But drugs, they've got a number of little initiatives. They want to crack that nut, and we'll see what happens there. The bottom line, though, is you have to start looking at all these criteria and say, well, if I have commodity volume whole goods that I'm not really doing any value-added processing to, and they are cream items. In other words, I have a lot of margin dollars per pick in that item. Those are going to be, you know, more vulnerable than others. And when you're confronted with, hey, I can buy this, you know, big margin dollar per pick content item somewhere else for 20% less, here's last look, you can't meet that. If you've got a very standard bundled service cost model, you need that extra margin dollars to pay for your losing stock keeping of picks and your losing customers. This next thing, maybe I'll be a little bit quicker on this is talking about sort of the chronological from our, you know, digital device and our doorstep at home or office back to Asian factories, all the different steps that Amazon has in their value chain. And as best they can, they'll turn everyone into a platform and let other people use it too. And maybe it might be helpful to say, as I go through these things, how's Walmart doing on these things? I mean, Walmart's using electronic commerce to, you know, pick stuff up at the curb, and they're trying to sell more stuff through store, and that's great. But when it comes to Walmart, you know, their website and all the other stuff they want to sell, and they want to have a marketplace too and whatever, they're woefully behind in all these things. So the first and biggest, most valuable platform they have is just Prime members. 105 million in the United States alone. They have 150 million, you know, globally. And basically, Bezos says, we are going to make Prime membership a sanity check. If you're not a Prime member, you are irresponsible. So everything they do they say, how's this going to, they come up with innovation metrics. And the ultimate innovation metric is, how will this help us to increase the number and loyalty and share of spend of Prime members? So that is an uber set of metrics for everything they're doing up and down their infrastructure. So right now they own, 60% of the U.S. households. They probably have about 90% plus of the discretionary spend. And the more these people go to Amazon and click, the more clickstream fuel they have to use machine learning, to use their ever declining, computing, cost power to make their artificial intelligent bots even smarter and do more cross-selling and do a better job at flowing inventory through their master DCs, their fulfillment centers, and so forth. The second big platform is because they've got the eyeballs, everybody says, well, I'd like to sell them. I'd like to rent your Prime members. And so if you look at the number, the quality of resellers, and when I say quality, Amazon imposes their brand, their service standards, et cetera, on them. They're not delivering perfect service on time, whatever. They just take their products off, they just delete them until they can get their act together. So when you've got the best 2 million resellers and climbing, selling 600 million stock keeping units, and many have the same thing. So you have a redundant fill rate. So if one guy doesn't have it, another guy has it, and you could still get it tomorrow. They reinforce one another. The more eyeballs you have, the more people that want to sell. The more stuff you have to sell, the more eyeballs people want to go there. Obviously, they have the best website experience. In theory, this is the easiest thing to see and try to knock off and copy. And most of the stuff that's on their website have been turned into what are called microservices, which you can actually subscribe to in the cloud for your own website. But I have no doubt that they have some secret sauce, one-click buying. They had a patent on that. That's expired, so that's now a microservice. You can get that too. But they're going to come up with other stuff. So they're always innovatively ahead, but what really works, they'll put it out there for other people to use if they want to. So that's easily copied, but forget one and two. Then four is just the content they have. The more people are there, the more videos they put on there, the more reviews and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, questions asked, et cetera, the more you want to go there. And that reinforces everything. Then, to offer on an unbundled basis fulfillment by Amazon, that allows a lot of people to say, wow, I can use their website and I can just ship the stuff there. And then I've got one-day service. Now I got to pay the fees. But obviously that's been a huge seller. And when you look at the scale of these warehouses, from click to ship, 15 minutes, total human labor content, $1. If the robots pick that item, it's 20 cents to pick it. If the humans have to pick that item in the narrow sense, it's 44 cents. And the more packages they're shipping out of a fulfillment center, 20, 30, 40, 50 an hour to zip code plus 4, 5, 6, 2 blocks kind of radius, you start to realize the density of shipping, the efficiency of last mile, which is the next platform, take off. And on last mile scale, you also look at the innovations. They just started up Amazon Delivery Partners a year ago. They've now got a zillion of these guys delivering packages. The average Amazon delivery partner is delivering 5 times the packages per mile of travel that UPS has. So they clearly have skimmed the cream. And because, again, of the massive amount of packages per hour to ever tighter geographic areas given to these partners, that's why you get this density. And then the Amazon locker teams, they're watching where more and more volumes go in, they're going out to those places saying, can we put in lockers to even speed up the delivery and the intensity of the density? And, they're going to do other stuff. I mean, obviously, they're working on rural drones and so forth. They will turn this into a platform, shipping with Amazon. So if anybody wants to ship a product from their place to a customer within a metro marketplace, same day delivery, you can hop on and you can schedule it and somebody will come by and pick it up and whatever. But they're going to be the house and they're going to provide the liquidity because on that platform, they're going to start up with all the Prime members buying stuff, all their stuff going out via the fulfillment center, all their delivery partners, and then everybody else can pile on. Because they've gotten so good at end-to-end interactive capability and everybody in this, the interfaces with the cloud can hop on there and digitally do it. They're now, you know, saying to governments, you're enormously inefficient. Put everything you're doing in the cloud, and here's why it works. That'll be a huge new area for them. Volkswagen plant said, could you put our entire inbound supply chain in the cloud? And they're doing that. So that'll be a whole new category of business that they'll go after. I've touched on already Amazon Global Logistics. That's a platform, and it allows a manufacturer anywhere in the world to say, as long as I can put together, a sub container or a container, but they will gather skids of stuff, put it in a combined container, ship the container to the United States. So their Amazon Global Logistics will get the stuff to our doorstep, and you have to pay fees for every little step along the way. And of course, a big platform is Amazon Web Services. So more and more people say, I want to run my business on the cloud. And the more people that run the cloud, the more little microservices they have, it's all good. Number 10, Alexa, voice commerce. We don't even know what these 15,000 people and all these two pizza teams have got, dreaming about. But, it's going to get here sooner and bigger and more surprising than maybe we think. And then I put other probable platforms, and I don't want to get too much in the weeds here, but basically, when you look at they do all Netflix streaming, and they do their own streaming. I mean, Amazon Web Services takes the best guess is about 1/3 of all the internet traffic on the planet goes to through Amazon Web Services. They don't want to share that because that's just another reason to bust them up or be worried anyway. But they have the ability to push stuff out at a 5G bandwidth level, so they're waiting for all of us to get 5G bandwidth phones. And then, we'll be able to watch videos of, with 100 times the download or the pixelization capability. Obviously, they're working aggressively on creating an advertising platform for all brands. They've patented reward points. So you may get an email saying, hey, if you watch this email, I watch this little video and answer these simple little questions and say, I'm not a robot, you're going to get some shopping points here at Amazon. And you think, wow, wait, a big brand could say, I'm going to ask Amazon for, how many people, eyeballs, do they have out there that have bought, looked at these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 things. And the more they've looked at, the fewer they are. And I'd like to send them a little opportunity to watch this educational video. And if they watch this, they get these points. They can watch another one and get some points. I mean, you could train the end user about what's new and why it's cool and why they want it, whatever. And you could do it tomorrow. And if you look at the total cost of what you pay Amazon for the search, match, and your reward point, it's going to be a fraction of trying to push that story through a channel over the next 18 months. So real-time education of end users or even channel members, it could be a possibility. I have no doubt that they'll get into banking services and there'll be, reward points for that. I've already talked about shipping with Amazon. They have a pilot going on in LA and London. But I think that they'll scale that up and we'll see what happens in healthcare. Down here in this little sort of detail thing, because of the trends in artificial intelligence, 5G bandwidth, millennials, who are digital buyers taking over buying positions, sort of just demographic trends, these will all continue to turbocharge the value and the volume and the interaction and the compounding of all these platforms. So yes, they do have a monopoly on prime people's first voice search, and eventually it'll be voice search. And then they have an infrastructure that's unmatchable. The infrastructure does not take the same share of vertical volume. It totally is contextual. They may take no share. They'll just be an advertising awareness capability. I mean, it could be life insurance. Any vertical that wants to sell something to prime eyeballs in a very targeted search, kind of way, will basically pay fees to Amazon. So they'll become this glorious 3PL for fees kind of business. This picture just tries to get across the idea that at the top, we have a product push pipeline where factories push it to distributors, who push it, to retailers, who push it to the end user. And in each little place, they each have their own little ERP system and their own little buyers who have to put together orders, and they got paper trade credit and purchase orders and stuff. It's all paper-based kind of stuff, pushing this stuff to the end user. Where in the lower scheme, you know, you see the screen in the center of the bottom. You know, I'm looking at a screen, and basically, you know, everybody's getting real-time information. Thank you, artificial intelligence, you know, robots that are going on. And the more I click, that data, you know, then gets monetized, and it gets used in multiple ways. That's the fuel that sort of makes it all go. And on the right-hand side here, vision stages, you know, most distributors say, oh, okay, I need to do, well, I'll get a better website and I'll bolt it onto my same old business model. They go, wait a minute, that's not actually starting with the customer. And I've got different sizes of customers and different categories of customers, and they have different needs. And the millennials want to buy in an e-selling interactive way. They don't want regular reps calling with donuts kind of thing. So I've got to start with customers and kind of work backwards into my business. And then, gee, to do that, I have to start to get much more flexible. I cannot have one standard go-to-market selling model with one monolithic commission program, whatever. That's not customer-centric. So, you know, it kind of, we sort of want to just, you know, bolt something onto the same old thing we've always been doing. Then we start to realize, gee, I've got to start doing some research with best customers and coming back into my business. But that makes me rethink, you know, how I do business, and I've got to be dynamically very flexible. This next slide, this just says that artificial intelligence is sort of overhyped and overrated. It works very well in repetitive, narrow kinds of things. You know, reading x-rays, for example, it works well. Playing in a game where the rules never change, chess, you know, it can work well, or Go. Thing. However, in real-world situations, you'll notice transport and logistics and retail, that's what Amazon does. And they have been investing in artificial intelligence and taking real-time click stream and figuring out what people are going to buy and where they're going to buy and how they're going to buy it. And that reflects on how they move stuff all the way through their channel. So it's lights out, there's no people, there's no paper, they've lower inventory investment for higher fill rates and faster response time to your doorstep. You know, you get 5, 10% better at 15 different factors, and that adds up to a real killer scenario. This one just shows you Amazon private labels, and the Amazon exclusive, these are basically factories saying, hey, I'm doing the manufacturing. Apple doesn't make any of their stuff. Cisco doesn't make any of their stuff. It's 100% outsourced to Asian, you know, sort of supply chain partners. So if somebody could say, wait a minute, I'm making faucets for Kohler here in China, why don't I just take their number one thing, tweak it, you know, rewrap it, whatever, and sell it for 50% less on Amazon tomorrow? I'm going to do that. And so they've had an explosion of these kinds of items using Amazon Global Logistics Service and Fulfillment by Amazon and so forth. So I put big question marks for, gee, how many more things do you think you'll find in the electronic space? How many more things will you find in the industrial space? Now I want to sort of focus on a sidebar topic, which is, why do private label products win? Why do, you know, showrooming, why does it happen? Why, when you go into Aldi or Lidl stores, you only have two SKUs for peanut butter? You get smooth and you get crunchy. That's it. You don't get big ones, small ones, all kinds of stuff, different brands, organic, this, that, whatever. You just get two SKUs. But those private labels are designed to be as good or better quality than the number one selling peanut butter brand, and they sell it for 50% less. What's the umbrella that these traditional suppliers are putting over there to allow these people to come in and sell for so much less and still make money? So we call it in retail showrooming. So kids go into stores and they, you know, they zap barcodes, they check stuff, they can buy for less, they hit the button and they buy from Amazon and it's there tomorrow, and as opposed to paying a little more to the store. And they strip the store of its local presence, its real estate overhead costs, its, you know, inventory on the floor, they suck the salesman for some stuff, that you're getting stripped of those services and that overhead value, and then you're getting your price shopped. But you have to say, well, why are they charging so much for the high definition TV? And what's the solution? So, for example, you know, Best Buy, in 2012, they got killed at Christmas on showrooming. So they basically tried to keep people from doing that. And they finally went to Samsung and those kind of guys and said, look, people come in here, they look at your products, they suck us dry for information, whatever, and then they buy your product from Amazon. You're still getting the sale, but we're getting screwed. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to take your stuff out of our store. The only reason, only way your stuff, so we have the footfall, people come here, they want to sniff stuff, check it out. So you want your stuff to be here? You're going to have to rent space, and you're going to have to put the showroom, that you're going to have to inventory the stuff. In other words, it's going to be your inventory, not ours. At first, they resist. They said, you know what? We need to do it. So there are ways to start to minimize the cross-subsidy that goes on between your cream items and the stupid dust collector losers that you may have. But, of course, web rooming is, how tough is it for me to, you know, check prices at Amazon, you know, for stuff you're selling me? And the answer is it's going to get radically easier over the next 2 or 3 years. So you have to say, well, how did this cross subsidy, you know, emerge, and why do I need profit equation management, which I'll cover in webinars 3 through 7, to solve this problem? And this basically just says that, you know, we think in terms of margin percentage, and a lot of distributors sort of work in a variant zone out of warehouse sales, so let's say 20 to 35%. So 35% is kind of list price. 20%, we sort of have to cut the price because, you know, it's big volume, it's price sensitive, people shop it. But if we looked at the order size, 20% on a $1,000 order gives me $200 of margin to pick it, pack it, ship it, you know, fool around with three-way paperwork, match, trade, credit, whatever in the back office. Whereas if I have a $10 order, but let's just, you know, rip them off. Let's have a 50% margin. Well, that's only $5 of margin dollars to pick it, package it, and all that sort of stuff. So that's obviously going to be a loser. And, of course, we have some customers that all they give us are small orders. They are systematically, structurally a losing customer. And, of course, on the flip side, we do have some customers that fortunately just call us once a week and give us a $1,000 order. And those actually turn out to be very profitable customers. If you took your total warehouse cost as a distributor and you divided by all the picks for the year, your cost to serve dollars per pick would blow your socks off. You'd go, oh my gosh, I cannot believe it. What are those guys doing out there? Well, they're doing a lot of stuff, but you have to have a warehouse to actually be able to pick and ship something to somebody. So all the upstream costs of actually doing line buys to replenish my warehouse stuff, that's part of having this stuff to be able to pick. So you take all these upstream costs and you start to look at the cost of service. You say, wow, I've got an infrastructure model that's frankly pretty expensive in contrast to Amazon's state-of-the-art robot, you know, et cetera, fulfillment centers. So you know, if you're a shot putter, don't try to do the mile. You're not going to do well. And if you're a miler, you can't even pick up the shot putter because you have no upper body strength because you're just your legs and lungs type of thing. So you have to be true to your infrastructure. Don't go after Amazon small orders and small customers if you're going to lose money on them. I don't care what the margin percent is. It's the margin dollars versus the cost to serve dollars. That's the profit equation. So notice that a profit equation is margin dollars, take away cost to serve dollars, equals profit dollars. There is no margin percent. In theory, margin percent is embedded as part of GP dollars. But if I have 50, 60, 70, 80% margin percent on a $1 pick, I still don't have enough margin dollars for the cost to serve of my infrastructure. Now, if you have a profit equation for every line item event in your business, you can add them all up and you get the year-end P&L. But you could add them up in different ways and get profit and loss statements in every SKU. You get a P&L in every vendor. You get a P&L in every product category. Or you could take a customer-centric approach. You need to add them all up for the orders per customer and get a P&L on a customer. You could add them all up and get a P&L for a sales territory. You could add them all up and get a P&L for a customer niche, a group of customers who tend to buy the same stuff in the same kind of way. And when you do this, you start to realize, oh my gosh, I've got these huge cross subsidies, which the digital disruptors will cherry pick you. They'll shred you. So as long as you are competing against other people who look at aggregated financial numbers and run their business that way and think that all their costs are fixed and they can take care of one more small order for free when 70% of their line items are unprofitable, it's a fair fight. But when the digital buyers can look at a screen in 2 seconds and say, wait a minute, I can buy this cream item for less there, did it, and still give you the losing stuff, you've got a problem. So here's some examples of cross subsidies, historically speaking. So you've got some sort of average price, and you have some people where you're making enormous amounts of money, and that cross subsidizes the losers. So for example, in the metro marketplace, if I'm making deliveries and I have a standard, I'm the United States Postal Service, all right? And I have a standard thing for a package, Postal Service. So it's $4, whether I deliver it around the corner, or to the North Slope of Alaska. Well, UPS comes along and says, you know what? We're gonna charge less just for the metro marketplace. And we're not even bother with the rural area. If we ever eventually get there, we're gonna have to charge what the rural area is gonna have to pay. Or when MCI and these other phone companies came along, they said, hey, here's the Bell monopoly. They're charging universal democratic prices, making massive amounts of money on big volume people close in and losing on all the little, you know, way out, you know, tiny, you know, consumers. We'll steal the cream and let them take care of the losers. If you go to walmart.com, and you type in Listerine mouthwash, I did it, you know, a while back, I got 625 hits. If I type in Equate mouthwash, Walmart's private label, I got 25. They do not knock off the whole line. They just knock off the number 1, 2, 3 selling sizes, colors, whatever, that they don't do the rest of the line. Think of selling ice cream. You know, if you go to Baskin-Robbins, 31 flavors, 5 flavors are 95% of the volume. 1 flavor, vanilla, is about 300% of the operating profit because the volume is so great. You know, you get sprinkles, you get all sorts of things with vanilla. It's sort of a neutral kind of base. The bottom 15 flavors, they get free tastes all month long, and then they have to hand pack them in quart things and discount it to try to get that stuff out the door. So there's huge cross subsidy going on there if you charge the same price per scoop. You say, well, wait a minute, the 31st flavor, I got to charge $20 a scoop. You can't sell it at $1 a scoop, the same price you're selling the rest of the stuff. So the problem is you have too many items that people don't want for the fair price that you have to charge. So distributors, because they run their business on aggregated financial averaged out numbers, they've got these hidden cross subsidies hiding. And then the disruptors come along, and really all they're doing is saying, who's the end user? How can we, you know, through their screen, get to them and offer them, you know, a better one-stop shop, information, whatever. How do we take pain, friction away from their relationship? And it works particularly on very experienced repeat buyers who do not need a relationship to shoot the breeze. Those are small, lonely customers, very busy people who are going places, want to go boom, 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 and buy it. And save money too, and get it quicker. So that's really what they're doing, is they're competing on business. They're not selling, they're selling the same stuff you are. So they're competing on business model innovation. So you've got to figure out how to come back and do the same thing and compete on channel model innovation. As your vendors start to do buyer and buyer engagement and create different buying journeys, that's going to create different scenarios that have to be seamless between the brand and the distributor. The distributors have to come up with different business models. Hey, you want to buy my website? And we have a dynamic configurator. The bigger your order, the more you can save. You know, we have to give them incentives to build their order to spread the cost of stopping a truck to delivery or doing, you know, paperwork or whatever. And I put down here some of the bigger digital disruptors where they basically said take an entire category and digitally take away pain. So we use, Amazon as the king. But, Airbnb, Zillow, Edmunds for cars, Zappos for shoes, and so forth. So we're all doing this. And guess what? Our customers are too. This just asks, how fast will the growth of more and more products and information pricing availability for more and more vendors, you know, become? And what kind of pressure does that put on showrooming or web rooming your cream items, or, you know, saying here's last look and you can't meet it because you've got a standard cost service model that isn't customer centric. And at the bottom here, this has already happened in other channels. If you go back to retail channels, Super Value, the grocery wholesaler, back then. By 1986, had a catalog of 185 and growing services for fees. Then they had another vision called food logistics, where they said, hey, you know, here's a guy who's got 13 grocery stores. He wants to buy his food from us. Here's our landed cost. You know, you tell us how you want to buy it, and you know, so forth, and we'll start adding these services onto it. And when the food logistics division would come and say, look, we can get this new contract and get more food volume. We love volume, baby. Maybe we'll get rebates from manufacturers for selling more of their stuff. But this prospective customer wants these 1, 2, 3 services for free. And the service division would say, well, we'll give them to them for free, and we'll bill you the difference. Well, that'll come out of our bottom line. Yeah, well, we're not giving away anything for free. So to keep people honest, that's what you got to do. If you pay your salespeople, go get margin dollars, why wouldn't they want to give away all the services for free, so including infinite trade credit and just-in-case inventory, et cetera? That helps to get and win margin dollars. They're just doing what you're paying them, as opposed to if salespeople had an incentive based on net profit of an account, they wouldn't be giving away service for free. That would cause the net profit factor to drop or become negative. The drug channel flipped similarly in the 80s. Hospital supply channel basically went from, you know, salespeople calling on buddies to national contracts and so forth. For 1996 to 2000, was very, very quick, abrupt switch. So one macro thing you see is the trend towards sort of e-integration of one-stop sole supply for stuff that somebody's buying. And, you know, the king of all of this would be McDonald's. They've had the same distributors forever. And the deal is McDonald's, you know, the distributors are totally transparent. They start with their landed cost, open book, and all the services get their fees for that. And McDonald's guarantees them an operating profit, a cost of capital margin percent, that gives the distributors a very generous, frankly, return on investment. But that gives the distributors the incentive to keep investing in innovation. So they've moved, McDonald's and the distributors have moved down the cost curve together over the last 60 years and counting. So, and this isn't for, you know, every customer, but certainly 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6% of your biggest customers who make the lion's share of all your profit, this is something you're going to have to get better at doing. When it comes to small customers and small orders, Jet.com sort of pioneered the idea of, okay, come build your order, and the more you, as you build it and add line items, you can dynamically see savings start to accumulate at the line item level if you buy a case instead of onesie twosie. At the bottom, at the overall level, you know, if you're getting to be to a threshold where we can cover the cost of the transact, the picking, the packing, the shipping, and so forth. If you go to Google OptiQuote, there's a chap who in the industrial supply space has actually pioneered doing that kind of a dynamic web calculator on their website. But the first thing that I think most distributors have to do is what I call a core renewal. This is what's called a whale curve. These are all the customers down here. So this guy overall has got over 3,000 active accounts over a number of locations, actually. And if we had profit equation management, net profit analytics, so we could know the profit of every customer, we take the number one most profitable customer here and we stack up their profits. So we take the number two and we stack up their profits. So we get up here to 0.2 sort of peak internal profits, and you can see about 10% of the customers are giving this distributor $2.5 million in net profit. Then there are a lot of customers that are break even, and when it starts to slope down, a lot of these are just little customers. You lose $5, $10, $20 on them. And the tail of the whale, these are customers that are actually very large in sales and margin dollars, and maybe they have a pretty good margin percent, but they have intergalactically huge small dollar picks and or small dollar orders. So their cost to serve dollars are much bigger than their margin dollars, so they're losers. But if you add them all up, the bottom line, the company makes this amount of money, about, $800,000 in operating profit. The next year, doing all the plays from the insights you get from net profit analytics, you can see they've truncated the tail a lot. It's much smaller set of big losers. And a lot of these guys went from losing a lot of money to switching over here and, you know, buying less often in greater quantities because they went out and educated these guys as to how their buying activity was very high cost for them and for the distributor. And by working together, they could come up with a way of converting lose-lose activity into win-win savings. And the customers were so happy, they gave them even more spend. So it's like alchemy. I mean, you are literally turning poop into gold over here. And then they have fewer accounts because they had a lot of little customers that were losers. And they basically, you know, spun them into a new division, gave them new prices and terms. And some of those guys said, forget it. We're not going to order half as often, twice as much, and pay a little bit more or have freight unbundled. We're going to go paralyze some distributor who doesn't know any better. He thinks every margin dollar is good. Forget cost to serve and order size and so forth. So, but the bottom line was their operating profit went from 800,000 up to about, I don't know, 1.2 million or whatever. And then the third year, 24 months later, you can see that their operating profit has gotten up to about five times what it was. They now have the profits and the confidence to reinvent themselves as far as an electronic commerce competitor. When you're here, you're so, you know, you're so busy losing money, you don't have time to think, let alone reinvent yourself. So I think that a core renewal is what you need to do first. If you go to my website at merrifieldact2.com, there's a tab for my core renewal roadmap that you might want to check out. And when you look at, you know, this model, you say, wait a minute, we have a standard selling service model for all these guys. We need something special for the small account division. But what about the super big accounts and going out and turning super losers into super winners? This is not a job that a sales guy can do calling on a buyer in their silo, and that buyer in the silo is playing politics and all they want to do is get price savings because that's the main metric. They don't care about the holistic, you know, total procurement cost, whatever system. That's a system that covers the whole company. I'm just here in my silo doing what I want to do. So you need basically a team to basically go to work on the biggest, best guys and make them even better, and go to work on these big guys and convert them to big winners. You may still have a chunk of customers that are old school. They're over 55 and you've been doing business and they're net profitable and they want to see their guy, and that's great. You know, do that as long as you can. Obviously, you have a minnow division and other things. In webinars 8, 9, 10, I get into, you know, new e-selling models and how to crack, you know, target whale accounts and so forth. But you know, once you have net profit analytics, you start to get these kinds of insights, then you need the plays to make them happen. So summary thoughts. All B2B brands are basically going to have to say, wait a minute, I got to go check my brand and my best SKUs on Amazon and look at the clones that are there, et cetera, decide, hey, you know, can I afford this? Maybe I need to pay up to Amazon to become Amazon Brand Registry and own my own search brand names and SKU code numbers, et cetera. And then when people do that, what's my digital engagement strategy? If you go to Amazon and look at Echo and look at the videos they have and all the questions they have, that shows you the potential of digital engagement, education, et cetera, that you can do. Distributors are basically going to have to concede some spot buy. If a small customer wants to buy a small amount of stuff and it's a loser for you with your infrastructure, you know, and you put in, you know, strict minimum orders, unbundled freight, whatever, they go, oh, forget that, I'm going to go somewhere else. Now, you may want to put in something like OptiQuote, because then, you know, and some guys will go, oh, well, wait a minute, this makes sense, and I can buy all my stuff here, one-stop shop and whatever. So it's a way of converting, you know, sort of, I'm out of it, I need it now, little guys into a little bit more planful buyers, and then they can get a better total service value. But otherwise, you know, maybe this is a blessing that some of these small customers are taking their money losing orders to Amazon. If you have net profit analytics, you can start to fix the cross subsidies. You can make a lot more money, and then you can, you know, start to do better what Amazon can't. And I think that's a key thing to do. So that is the end of the story. Thank you very much.